Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
I am delighted now to be joined by a true Renaissance Irishwoman, Sinéad Burke, founder and CEO of Tilting the Lens. She's a writer, a broadcaster, an activist. Sinéad, you never stop, you're always on the go.
Good morning. What a treat to be here. So lovely to see you, Deborah.
I know, to finally get you to stop for a little bit, because you are always on the go. And you've actually just joined us. You were in Geneva earlier this week, speaking at a UN conference. What was that about?
Yeah, I was speaking at the United Nations Global Platform for Disaster Risk and Resilience. So my focus there was in thinking about, from a systems perspective, particularly in times of crisis with disasters, how are disabled people and anybody who's kind of marginalised or from vulnerable communities considered within communications, within planning, within investment? And it was just such a privilege to be there alongside so many disabled people, alongside world leaders, really trying to think about the problems of today, but also those of tomorrow.
It's really interesting. I had friends who were caught up in the in Storm Owen, you know, able-bodied, well-resourced people who just spoke about the trauma and the difficulty of that time and not having connections and all of those challenges. And it's in that sort of a context of looking at through disaster planning, through that lens. Because when you look at the LA wildfires that there were recently, like, it was really difficult for people who had mobility issues or other challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at, to your point, Los Angeles, or if you look at, you know, the Philippines, or if you look at Southeast Asia, you know, which I think experienced so much more of the climate change that perhaps hasn't reached us just yet in this part of the world. Thinking around access as a systemic issue for planning, for risk, but also for recovery, I think has to be really fundamentally part of it. One of the big priorities around disaster risk and resilience is around early warnings. So making sure, whether that is through, you know, broadcast communications on your phone, whether that is through broadcasting and television. But I think one of the focuses of early warnings for all is, how is it accessible and how is it actually for all? So if we think about how often, you know, sirens are used to be able for people to identify that there's going to be a disaster coming, that is not accessible to deaf people. How are we making sure that planning or resilience information is communicated in multiple languages, in plain language, and isn't excluding those who are most marginalised? And, you know, you give the example of Los Angeles and the wildfires, which, you know, in many ways, those with the most privilege were still affected by, but not to the same degree as those with the least amount of privilege. But some of the challenges that we learned about Los Angeles was, you know, in thinking about the many people who had to leave their disabled relatives in their homes because there wasn't accessible transport to be able to get them out, but also just not enough information about people having to migrate from their homes. So I think, you know, that looks like a very stark contrast to what we have in Ireland, to your point, but Storm Éowyn is a great example. But even just the day-to-day, you know, we look at what happened in Grenfell in the United Kingdom, where if you're a person who's a wheelchair user or have a mobility issue, you know, in a fire within that building, the elevators often turn off in order to ensure that nobody gets trapped. And if you have a physical disability, you're often told to go to a refuge point and to wait in the hope that a firefighter or somebody will come and rescue you. And what that rescue looks like, if it happens, is, you know, an evacuation chair, which is terribly uncomfortable, potentially unsafe. But it's just this acceptance that we have as a society that if you have a physical disability, your role is to wait to be rescued, rather than infrastructure, even in a building, in an office design, anywhere, even in a home, to be able to get you out safely and independently. So I think part of the conversation in Geneva was, how do we centre the people with that lived experience at the centre of the conversations to be not just consulted, but decision makers and leaders, so that we are creating safe spaces for everyone.
Of which you're one, like, I know you've been working with presidents, with all different organisations all over the world, and you are so well versed, and it seems very comfortable now in those corridors of power. What was it like speaking at the UN? Is it just another forum, or was there a bit of a intake of breath moment?
Absolute intake of breath. You know, I'd be very honest, I did a huge amount of preparation in advance. You know, I spoke to mentors and people who are deeply involved in the space, from Rebecca Coakley in the Ford Foundation to Paul in the US, who kind of works on lighthouse recoveries, to the Department of Foreign Affairs here, to really try to understand, both from a national and global context, what are the real systemic challenges. But absolutely, in the moments before I addressed the United Nations, which is a bizarre phrase to be able to utter out loud, you know, you're sweating, talking fast, trying to calm down, and you only hope, you know, that the purpose of being in that room is to add value, to be able to facilitate conversation and to spark new ideas.
So I have to ask you, because there's a wee vacancy in a house in North Dublin later this year. Has the body of work that you've done over, particularly over the last decade or so, would it inspire you to run for political office or, I don't know, the presidency? But would it inspire you to run for office, you know, because of that voice and status that you have gained?
I think any role of a public nature, you know, be that a presidency, be that in government, be that, I don't know, a board member, for example, has to be about you adding value and you being the right person to be able to bring either the values or the work to it. I am not yet 35. I will be 35 in September, but I am very early in my career. You know, I set up Tilting the Lens 4.5 years ago to very deliberately move the definition of success from me as an individual and from visibility to systemic change and to creating a collective of largely disabled women to be working on projects nationally and globally to think about that change. Because very honestly, change can't be about the success or the fluency or the visibility or the positioning of one person, but it has to be about all of us, particularly through a lens of intersectionality. And at 35, while I'm very proud of what I have achieved and been able to be involved in to date, there's still so much work to do. And I'm going to have my sleeves rolled up and head down doing that work.
One of the, I'm going to take out that was not a no for the presidency potentially in the future, but one of the things that you have been working on, there's new legislation coming in across Europe this month, and it's the European Accessibility Act, and it covers quite a broad range of things, ATM machines, you know, banking, it's lots of different things. Is that going to make a difference for people with disabilities, particularly in the areas of employment and areas like that?
So on June 28th of this year, the European Accessibility Act will come into law and a monitoring process will begin. So maybe to give a sense of the scale, you know, I think with lots of new legislation, companies of a certain size are the only ones that have to engage in this. So the only companies that are exempt from the European Accessibility Act are micro-enterprises. So if you have more than 10 employees and if your revenue is more than 2 million euro a year, you have to adhere to the European Accessibility Act by June 28th. Now, every member state within the EU has implemented the act slightly differently. So in Ireland, we have some exemptions that we have carved out that we don't have to put in place right away, but we'll have to over the next 20 years. So two of those for us is the built environment in terms of physical space and design and ATMs. So we don't yet have to put them through the confines of the European Accessibility Act. But many other products and services. So if you're a company, you don't even have to be based in the EU. But if you're a company that's trading into the EU, there is new criteria that you will have to meet. So that is specifically around your website and app design. That is about the design of products and services. Now, some of this differs by industry. So if you're in banking, which is highly regulated, there is much more matriculation of what you have to do to be accessible. But for me, what I think is the opportunity is one, seeing the innovation within accessibility. I think with any new regulation, we adopt a compliance mindset, whether we think about GDPR, whether we think about even quotas
instead
around employment.
Enabling one.
And in just thinking about the opportunity, you know, so when you, by June 28th, many companies will be compliant with the European Accessibility Act. Great. What next? And also the reality that accessibility is transient. So just because you're accessible on June 28th doesn't mean you will be on June 30th or July 15th. So it is a constant process within the way in which we work that has to be embedded. But I really hope that what we can not just see is the innovation, but also begin to measure what's the opportunity in employing diverse and disabled talent to be able to add value to our organisation, not merely as an act of charity, but also what's the opportunity in just designing better products and services. You know, if we kind of even scale it back to what accessibility looks like day to day now. Like if anybody watches Netflix, Disney Plus, Amazon Prime, you know, most people we know from the data are watching that content with captions and subtitles on. That's specifically an accessibility requirement for those who are deaf or hard of hearing or who those speak a different language. But it's become part of our human engagement with content and with material. So how do we just embed accessibility as business as usual in every industry as part of our process? So I'm really hoping we see it as an opportunity. I know there's lots of organisations and bodies being set up in Ireland and across the EU for monitoring it. But I think for me, my big hope is we shouldn't aim to be compliant. Compliant should be our starting point, and we should aim to be creating better products and services.
You have been such a pioneer and someone out front talking about these issues for quite some time. From a personal vantage point, has that taken a toll on you personally, you know, because you have been so vocal?
I live with a very visible apparent disability, which is not so visible or apparent on radio, but I have dwarfism. I stand at the height of 3 feet 5 inches tall, and being a physically disabled and apparently disabled person, you know, has an impact on how I engage with the world and how the world engages with me. I do think that the migration of moving from being an individual advocate to being CEO of a business and having a team of people, of colleagues and people to work together, has made the journey much less lonely, much less individual. But I think, you know, it is difficult to distance yourself from it, in the sense that the work that I'm doing is very much rooted in not just my own independence, but the independence of, you know, a community. And there are many, many people doing this work. So I think on the days when it's tough and it's hard, it's, you know, difficult to close the laptop and for it not to be and to feel personal. But that's also, I think, what is the driving force behind it.
Or were you, you know, the European Accessibility Act is a step forward, mm-hmm. we hope, for Europe. But we were just speaking to Mark a little earlier just about the US. And, you know, you've seen this huge pushback against DEI, you know, executive orders and a change, maybe even a sort of a censorship around issues that people were previously more more willing to talk about. Has that been, do you see that as a setback? Is that something that disturbs you, that sort of that change in the tone of the conversation?
I think two things. You know, one, I think there's lots of people who are really being harmed by this change, whether that's members of the trans community, whether that's migrants, whether that's Muslim people, for example. And I don't want my next comments to arise from that harm that is and that people are feeling, right? People are being separated from families, etc. But I think what I am seeing on the alternative perspective is that, you know, the executive orders exist, but in terms of the legal strength of those executive orders, they are being questioned day by day. I think what we're also seeing is that whilst some companies, particularly because of activist shareholders within board meetings, have taken a step back and a reframing around DE&I, many others have not. And I feel great hope in that. So if we look at Apple, if we look at Costco, if we look at Google even this week, large global giants who are rejecting those votes, rejecting that activism in a way within those boardrooms. I think what we're seeing from a DE&I perspective is that many companies, particularly those that are publicly owned and have shareholders, are changing the framing of DE&I within their organization. So, for example, if somebody previously was a head of DE&I, they may now have a title of head of employee belonging or head of employee retention. And I think one of the...
Because a lot of it just gets caught up in the language.
In the language. And yeah. I think, you know, it's worth asking what was or is DE&I. And I think my understanding of it is that it's a framework to ensure that people have the resources, the skills, and are working in the environment that they need to succeed. Where I'm seeing the change is, to your point, a move away from the language, but more focusing on creating fairer systems. And that idea of fairer systems for everybody. So if you are a white person from a working class background, there are many environments in which are not fair to you. So how do we take the burden and the responsibility from one individual, whether that's a head of DE&I or whether that's one marginalized person in an organization, and it's their responsibility to fix things, and instead moving it of how do we create better systems? And I think about the work that I've previously had the privilege of doing with publicjobs.ie in terms of redesigning the reasonable accommodations process for the Irish public and civil service. And part of that is how do we build and embed system design? So if you're a disabled person, you may have an access accommodation a need in order to be successful at your job. But also if you're a person who has had a temporary injury, if you're a person who has just had a cancer diagnosis, the reality is we will all need the system to be fairer or the system to adjust for us over the course of our lifetime, whether that's in work or whether that's as citizens.
And one system and industry which you sort of took by storm on the cover of Vogue, not once but twice, and you really advocated for change in that industry. Has it changed much, do you think, since you have brought about some of that work, which for you was highly visible?
I mean, Derval, I think you and I were together in Paris in 2019 when I had the privilege of being on the cover of Vogue for the first time, which is a wild sentence to be able to say out loud. And I think, you know, the pandemic was a really transformative moment for me personally and professionally. And I feel very proud about the evolvement from being on the cover in 2019, which was a very important moment for me personally, to then being able to be the consulting editor with Tilting the Lens in 2023, where we put 5 disabled people on the cover, 19 disabled people inside. The magazine was available in Braille for the first time ever and continues to be. But I think, you know, one of the things that we need to be really careful of when we're measuring success is that visibility cannot be the only definition of success. So one of the things that I have really tried to advocate on and around is having greater representation on the front row or on the runway within fashion is vitally important. But it's not the only aspect of fashion that we should be ambitious to change. I really want disabled fashion designers to exist. As we think about even the evolvement of adaptive fashion, it's really important. But again, disabled people are not just consumers. So we have a scholarship program with Parsons School of Design in New York, where we currently have 6 disabled people doing degree and master's programs who are disabled, who will be the next generation of disabled fashion designers. And our job now is to get those people employed and get them into jobs. But, you know, I want fashion editors to be disabled. I want that representation at every level of the industry.
Your optimism is relentless. What keeps you going?
Therapy, very honestly. But also, you know, I have no choice but to be optimistic. This is my life. I was born disabled. I didn't acquire my disability. I will be disabled for my whole life. I live in a world that disables me, both in terms of the built environment and in terms of the people, the policies and the mindsets. So while I'm striving for change, the reality is I know this change will hopefully take effect while I exist, but will probably not and will take much longer. But for me, it's about the next generation of people. And I'm building on the work of many generations of disabled advocates who came before me, that it will be easier, less friction. And I think, of course, there's an ease in this moment where we do feel downtrodden, but we can't afford to be complacent.
We cannot, and I can't afford to talk to you any further, because you were out at UCD today as part of the UCD Festival. An audience with Sinead Burka begins this afternoon, I think at 2:30, and tickets are free, but you can book if you're required at ucd.ie. And I know you'll be signing copies of your book, Break the Mould, after that. But Sinead Burka, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.